Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, your monthly literary snacks for the mind and interviews. I'm Sandy Harper here with my co-host Dick Reichman and a very special guest, an old friend who demonstrates that you can take the boy out of New England, but you can't take New England out of the boy. It's Mike McCormick, founder of Whistling Swan.
Good morning, Sandy. Good afternoon, Sandy. Great to be here. Great to be here with you too, Dick.
Good afternoon.
Well, actually, I'm old friends with Katie as well, Katie Spangler, who is Mike's wife. We worked together in the Alaska Center for the Book many years ago as well. So how did you cook up Whistling Swan?
Oh, my gosh, Sandy, that's a big question. It actually goes back to the early 70s when I was in New England and I was a college student at UMass. And I really missed not seeing blues music. Like, blues musicians would come by Amherst on the way to Boston, which was 100 miles away. And I thought it was really stupid that I would have to then hitchhike or drive to Boston to see their shows on the weekend. So I called the college radio station where there was a blues show and started a blues music club with the college radio guy and started concert promotion and just totally loved it. And we just did exclusively blues artists, you know, people like Hound Dog Taylor and the House Rock and Otis Rush and Mance Lipscomb, Joseph Spence, people like that. And then when I came to Alaska in 1976, totally loved it, you know, loved everything. But the only thing I missed was some of the live music in the Red Sox and Celtics.
Of course.
And Katie and I got together, and she missed music, you know, too, because she grew up in Seattle and did a lot of live music. And we were in Juneau, excuse me, in 1987, and one of our favorite New England musicians, Bill Staines, was bypassing Juneau and coming up and playing Talkeetna. So we said, oh, that's terrible. So we called him up and rearranged. We did a fundraiser for the Alaska Folk Festival in 1987 in Juneau. Katie and I did all the work, and they provided their advertisement a little bit, and it was really successful. Then we came back to Anchorage in the early 90s, and Bill Staines, we went to see Bill one night in a bar in Anchorage, and it was terrible. It was like 400 empty seats, about 10 people were there. It was very, very depressing. And we loved Bill, and we loved his music, and we said, we can't have this. One of the other 10 people was a community school coordinator, and we said, hey, Daryl, how about if we get together next year, and we'll hire Bill, and we'll do it as a fundraiser as community schools. So that was about 1991, and we did a number of fundraisers for community schools with Bill Staines, Brian Bowers, Greg Brown, John McCutcheon, and we loved it. We loved that so much, and people started saying, hey, do more concerts. So that's when we founded Whistling Swan in 1994, Katie and I. And as soon as the kids were old enough, Katie and I and the kids, Patrick and Mary.
Yeah, you guys have been real entrepreneurs for the music scene here, the alternative music scene and folk music scene. I remember the very early days you actually were at Cyrano's with Dan Byrne.
That was some of the most fun concerts ever. Now, Dan Byrne, we've introduced, I introduced him on stage 27 times. And people still talk about that Cyrano show. What it was is we had two shows, two completely different shows, and he did about 20 songs each show. So it was like he repeated one song. He has a Santa Claus song. It was almost Christmas, you know. And remember, Sandy, you had to get him off the phone because his girlfriend, and he was on the phone with right up until the time he walked on stage, his girlfriend was Martha Wainwright, who has become quite a star in her own name. So he was on the phone with her in Cyrano's. Oh. And we actually have recordings of that show. And, you know,
My favorite song is the one about Marilyn Monroe. What if she had married Henry Miller instead of Arthur Miller?
Yeah, he still does. Right. But that's like when people, like there's some people that have been to all those shows, like they've seen them like 24 times, and that's the one they, in their heart, they remember. And Dan still recalls it,
That's so nice.
So it was great. And we had some other wonderful shows in Cyrano. It was great. You know, it was like a big risk for us because it was like the first time we ever dared to do a show on a weeknight was at Cyrano's with a woman from Utah called Cozy Sheridan. We got maybe 40, 50 people. We said, oh my God, we can do shows on weeknights, you know. And then maybe we had Dan, and it was just before Christmas, and that was a weeknight. And we sold out both shows. It was great. And the 99 seats, I think, at that time was what it was if we snuck one extra seat in the corner. Yeah, and then some other really wonderful shows. I always remember this Peter Mulby, Jennifer Kimball, Double Bill. And then the guy who, he's still around, he's moved to Austin. He's way under the radar, but I think he's the best living acoustic blues man in the United States or the world. Paul Jeremiah played there a show. And Paul's one of these guys that he doesn't think in terms of sets or in anything. He's just all music. He's not an entertainer. And I mean, it's the only time just about I had to really flash the lights on a person because he was doing two sets and he was about into 100 minutes in his first set. It's like, Paul, you've gone, you know. So he came off and then he went and did. So he did, a full 2.5 hours or something of music at Serenos that night on a Tuesday night
That's right.
It was wonderful. But yeah, just great memories of Serenos. And you guys were great. You sold the tickets before Center Ticks. We sold the tickets out of, you know.
Your whole family was involved,
yeah,
I remember.
And your whole family too. So it was great.
Well, now you've taken the quantum leap. You're now performing this next season at the Wendy Williamson, which is like 1,000 people can come.
Yeah, we use the Wendy Williamson sometimes in like with Hot Tuna, which is going to be October 8th. We like to have a place where people can stand up and move around a little bit because it's going to be an electric show. We've hired them twice before as acoustic, and we know people are going to want to dance a little bit. So we're going to have the front row is going to be, we're going to tape up the seats, and people are going to be, there's plenty of room right in front of stage dance. But the Wendy's so nice because it's like an amphitheater, so there's plenty of room for people to sit, and they won't have any obstructed views, and they can just see. So you can choose your way. You know, it's like, oh, I got to be on my feet, man, for this. Great. Or I'm not going to be standing up for no 2 or 3 hours of music. I'm going to sit. So everybody be happy and it should be a blast.
Right. And I know you've played the pack as well with Whistling Swan. And
yeah, it was really nice. About 3 years into it, we were asked to come on as resident company because the perception, which I think was accurate, was we were offering something that wasn't being offered by the other groups that were resident companies. So that was great. We were honored. And the Performing Arts Center has helped us so much. I mean, in every aspect of what we do, it's just been incredible. I mean, we would not be in existence without the help of the people at the Performing Arts Center. Just totally great people.
They are indeed. So tell us a little about what you do, because I remember the early days, the people would, you would meet them at the plane, they'd stay at your house, and maybe they still are staying at your house.
Yeah, sometimes people do stay at our house, but part of it was the only way we could make ends meet. You know, that hotel bill, you know, those add up, you know, and we're really, you know, we don't have much money as far as, we don't have much of a profit margin. So sometimes just even make ends meet, we say, if you know, in the office, we can put you up at our house. And we actually have it's really nice. We have a downstairs that's, you know, totally free. So they have the laundry right there. They have their, you know, the bathrooms right there. And I have a huge record collection, which more than one person has really enjoyed, and a huge book collection. So, yeah, we've had a bunch of people at the house, and we still occasionally have people at the house. We had a show last year, which we had Peter Mulvey and Aeneas Mitchell both at the house. And then Peter brought two friends from Ireland. So we had four of them at the house, and that was a blast, you know. And now that we're empty nesters, we actually had rooms for all of them, you know. So, yeah, we have a nice time with that.
The Guinness and good times flowed.
yeah.
Well, how do you pick your artists for the season? You have a wonderful lineup.
Yeah. Well, there's all kinds of things. One of the challenges now is we've had, 300 different artists and about 400 different shows. And so I'd say 98 or 99% of the shows we've been thrilled with, which means 98 or 99% of the artists we'd love to bring back. But we're always hearing new people that we love. So we try to have a balance between new people and old people. And usually it's about 40 or 50% of each. Sometimes we'll bring a new artist, such as we just did with the Swedish trio Baskery, and put them together with the artist that has come, which in this case was Hamel on Trial. So that helps build for both artists. It brings new people in. We're doing that with Cheryl Wheeler and Dan Tomisky. Cheryl's been here a number of times. She usually draws a really nice house. She sold out more shows than not, and always a full house. And Dan has never been here. So we think their artists, their audiences will enjoy each other's music. You know, they're complimentary. Cheryl used to live in Nashville and has written some songs that a number of people like Bette Midler and Susie Bogus have had huge hits with. And Dan has been with Alison Krauss, so he's known in country circles and in bluegrass circles for his playing. He was the voice in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
So
he's a like 18-time Grammy Award winner, mostly with Alison Krauss. But so it's great. It's going to be a great bill. So we love that, putting the two things together in different artists and seeing how sometimes they interact and they come up with something that's truly inspired for both of them. On one occasion, we had Chris Whitley and Jeff Lang. Jeff's an Australian. Chris was from Texas. And out of their collaboration, they went on and actually recorded an album that they released, you know. But they actually got together on a tour up here and became closer friends. So you never know what happens with some of these things, some of these ideas we pull together. It's fun. It gets, you know, you get lucky sometimes, and it really, really is a blast.
It sure sounds like it. And then, of course, you're sort of an entrepreneur and producer over at UAA as well.
Well, not really. I'm the assistant director of student activities over at UAA, and my job is to work with students to help students put on and learn and do things to use entertainment and lectures and the arts as a vehicle for their own learning to help students get engaged in campus, in their lives, to, you know, it's just about the students.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Everything that we do is for the students. I might bring my expertise and suggest some things. For instance, I'll say, hey, have you heard of this artist? And throw out the artist to them. And they'll research and say, hey, that's pretty good. And, you know, a group of other artists, too. And they also bring, you know, best of all is when they bring their people that they said, we really are interested, these people, bring them to campus. Then I work with them to see how they can get hired and how to promote the show. And so they learn. So when students leave our employment as student activities, we feel that they can go on and they can do anything. They can put on any event. We had a really nice thing happen about, well, not this summer, the summer before. We had a student from British Columbia who went back to her hometown in British Columbia and was, you know, looking for a job, and she ended up getting hired to be the manager of a theater that had been in business for 75 years, based totally on her experience working at student activities. So that's great. The other component of the job, one of the main components that's really exciting, is we have a student gallery. And again, it's almost exclusively student shows. The students put the shows together, they mount them, they set up the openings, they promote them. So again, a laboratory for students to learn, a laboratory for student engagement is fantastic. And looking at my own life, I wouldn't have done Whistling Swan, I'd been sitting here, if I hadn't been involved in student activities at UMass and started the UMass Blues Club. So this is kind of going full circle. So it's really exciting. But if you think, you know, people, if you talk to them about their college experience, often they learn more as much outside of the classroom with things like student activities than they do in the classroom. And it's really great, too, when we have someone from marketing or someone from a writing program who can come in and use their skills and stretch their skills, you know, working with us in student activities.
And it's such a tangible outcome.
Yeah, it's so great. It's a back and forth thing. It's also been fantastic. Like, one of the things we get involved in is, like, for instance, we have a Martin Luther King Student Appreciation Luncheon and lecture, and we brought people like Nikki Giovanni in
Taylor
Branch, and just incredible people. And to have our students be able to be with these people, to work with these people, talk to these people, research about these people, it's incredible. It really is. We had one student who had some friends who went to Ivy League schools, you know, a few years ago, working with us. And his Ivy League friends, you know, did not have the opportunities that this student had to go and introduce a Pulitzer Prize winner, you know, to sit down one-on-one and interview. You know, we're given fantastic opportunities at UAA. It's just so thrilling to be at that school right now.
It really is. It really is. I was there recently for the Sherman Alexie, and that was great.
Yeah, that was so fun. And for the students, again, to do that. And, you know, before that lecture, what he did is he went over to the Native Studies program, took off his coat, sat down, and he just sat there for like 2.5-3 hours, talked to anybody as long as they wanted about anything, you know, like face-to-face, just like we're doing now, one-on-one. Fantastic, you know. And then remember the beginning of the lecture, how he asked all the students to stand, and he really honored the students. Mm-hmm. And then after the lecture, how the students came up and met him. And for me to sit there and see what him being on campus, meeting the students, how important that was. Sort of similar, last year we got to work with, the last 2 years we got to work with Dan Savage. And that guy really gave to the students a lot, to sit down with them, to go to breakfast with them, to talk to the journalists about journalism. Just amazing. So sometimes when we do things, the public lecture is one thing, but often extends way, way, way beyond that. We try to have as many interactions with the students as possible so the students can learn and have something that they can take. We're really excited. On October 8th, we start homecoming, mm-hmm. and we have like 35 events, you know, and student activities is working with some of them, and I also work on a programming board. The programming board's getting all set. So we're going to have like things every night. There's the hockey game, the Kendall Classic. There's a magician coming. Stephen Lynch, fantastic comedian. We have the Acapella Festivella, which, Sandy, this is one of the great traditional events in our arts calendar. Now, I think it's like 20 years or close to 20 years. I'm not sure the exact number, but we're having that, and that fills up the Wendy every year. And this year, we have the Dirty Dozen Brass Band coming in from New Orleans. We are psyched for them. But to give you an idea, what's happening is when they come in, they're going to give a brass workshop to the brass students on campus. Then we're going to have students open the show for them, you know, a student band. So, you know, it's different interactions. And then they're also going to do like a noontime thing, and we're not sure exactly what format that's going to take. But again, we're going to have students engaged all the time. The students are out there promoting the show. It's wicked exciting. You know?
Your enthusiasm is definitely contagious to me, and I'm sure the students.
Oh, it is so fun. You know, it is really fun over there.
And you're also helping Northern Lights out. They get a lot to write about.
Yeah, that's right. And we try to set up the Northern Light and KRUA for interviews, you know, and that's been a whole nice thing. Like, even like one of the things I was just thinking about looking at the paper is we had Jonah Goldberg, you know, the political columnist, you know, last year. And that was great to have several people. The Alaska Press Club came over to campus and worked with some student journalists to do an on-air interview with him. You know, and that's great. And what an opportunity for our student journalists to interview someone like that and then to talk about, you know, how do you write a column, how do you get syndicated. Just tremendous.
I think that is so wonderful because it's not theoretical. The kids, you're really doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, so, well, I like you said, too, UAA is particularly noted for this. It isn't common at other schools, this kind of programming.
Well, it is. You know, I don't know all the other schools, but what we're doing is just, it's amazing. I mean, when you look at Sherman Alexie and Nikki Giovanni and Arun Gandhi and people like that, you know, coming. And then just last week, the Butler Lecture Series had Terry Tempest Williams, the foremost, I think, environmental writer in the country, you know, and if you saw the Ken Burns special on PBS with National Park, she was featured in that, and she's a longtime friend of Alaska. I actually met her at the Sitka Writers Symposium about 25 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, and I had a really, you know, I got to know her pretty well. She was a fairly unknown writer, and it was before she put out Refuge, so she was like the least famous writer there, so, you know, she was very accessible, and she continues to be very accessible.
Yeah, Refuge is a classic. Yeah.
But again, you know, it was so great that we can have her on campus. And then next week at homecoming, we have Thomas Lovejoy coming, you know, another fine speaker. So just tons of stuff.
Tell me a little bit about Thomas Lovejoy because I'm not familiar with him.
Yeah, I'm not deeply familiar, but he's on PBS TV and has different things that he offers. So and his topic will be sustainability.
Oh.
So yeah, and one of the things that's great at UAA is that Chancellor is very involved, and you know she's on Obama's commission, and I understand she was one of the main proponents for having him come to campus. So it's great to be on a campus with such an involved and concerned and talented chancellor.
Absolutely.
Because every campus doesn't have that. And it's great, you know, for the students, too, because we see her around the campus, and she comes to a number of the events that the students are putting on. So that's great. It makes the students feel honored. It makes, you know, they love when they see her there. They say, oh, the chancellor's here.
A real live human being.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, it really is fantastic. And the students noticed that she was at the Bartlett Lecture Series. And so it was neat.
Did you know in her early days she was also an opera singer before she went into politics?
when I was in Juneau, I remember she's very involved in the singing community.
Yeah. I think that's kind of wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. It's great when you have people that are so multifaceted as your leaders.
Exactly. So I'm kind of fascinated by how you put this together, because do you sit down with the students the semester before and you kind of put some things on the table, they put some things on the table, and you
well,
have arts thematic?
We have some fixed events, you mm-hmm. know, like the Martin Luther King Student Appreciation lecture and luncheon mm-hmm. That we have. And then the a cappella festival, the students I work with don't do this, the concert board, but, mm-hmm. you know, we all work together and interact. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to put, when we step back, we try to say that we have provided opportunities for the whole diverse range of our students. You know, and we have a huge student body, and it's diverse, and it's also a commuter student body. It's about 93% commuter. So our goal is to have something for everybody, and it's a challenge. And so what we try to do is we try to have a diverse team of students that can represent the diversity of our campus. And we look at that, and we step back, and we try to have some comedy. We try to have some lectures. We try to have some music. The other thing is food events are very popular. So we have barbecues. We have ice cream socials. In June, we have this wonderful Juneteenth barbecue, of longstanding, you know, way beyond when I was there. The Banff Mountain Film Festival, we've had that for, again, over a dozen, 15 years. And that's one of the first, if not the first, film festival that's played annually in Anchorage. That goes, you know, way back, and definitely this is the first, the UAA student activity is the first group to present this film festival in Alaska, and this international, it plays all over the world. So that's a great thing, and that's in March, coming March 10th and 11th. So we look at that.
How exciting.
Yeah,
it is.
It's really exciting, and now with the campus growing, we're growing too, and we're trying to, you know, the needs are changing, and we're trying to meet these needs. And again, the bottom line is we want all students to be engaged. We want all students to be successful. We know from research that students that are engaged in campus, they're more likely to do a good job with their studies. They'll feel connected. It's a great challenge, again, since we're growing, changing, and we're mostly a commuter campus, to have students engaged. But and there's different things that engage different students. So it's terrific.
Sometimes, but that's powerful things. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. It is powerful. You know, sometimes it's a comedian, sometimes it's a concert, sometimes it's a lecture, sometimes it's just going in. Like, we have a number of students we know that always go to our gallery. And every time the show changes, which is about every 3 weeks, they're in the gallery again. So that's great. And then the student artists have the opportunity to, you know, in another place where they can display their works. So it's super.
Yeah. But I was just thinking, even beyond that, for the real world, on their resumes, not only giving them enthusiasm to try, but it's very terrific to have that on their resumes.
Yeah, we have. We also have our own little graphics department. The students do all the graphics and the posters. And the students have not had a problem when they graduate, even though it's not their major, maybe, to get a job, you know, doing graphics, because they're doing everything.
Of the world.
Putting things like, print ads together. They're doing posters. They're doing press releases. And increasingly, they're doing web design.
Very, very good. So I want to ask you something, flashback to your youth and childhood, Michael. Somehow you became enthused about music, and then sharing your love and encouraging and igniting it for other people. What did you just start spending your allowance on records when you were a kid, or what happened?
I actually did. You know, my dad was the custodian of the Catholic school. Mm-hmm. I got baptized so I could go to the school where he worked. And so I used to shovel coal every day, you know, in the morning, you know, in the winter, to fill the coal bins. And so I always had money. You know, I got about $1 an hour from that. And you know, the paper routes and stuff. So always had money, and it always went to records. And then clothes, like the mod fashions. You know, I remember trying to dress like the Who, like the Barbarians. And one of the funniest things ever was, you know, one of the joys was we hired Roger McGuinn of the Birds. And when I was a kid, I got these granny glasses that looked as close as I could get to the glasses Roger McGuinn was wearing on the second Birds album, Turn, Turn, Turn. And I really tried to look like him. So to pick that guy up at the airport and have him stay in our house, you stay in our house for 3 days, it was unbelievable. It was like, it just killed me, you know. So, Katie and I were walking around the kitchen and we hear Mr. Tambourine Man, the guitar. Live from our basement. It just killed us. It was like, we get goosebumps, you know how that is? You know, and a couple other things like people that I used to see in high school, when I was in New England, to have them go to dinner and hire them, like Chris Smither. I remember I wrote an article on him in my high school paper, which I still have. And I met him in the bathroom in Passim's, which is a legendary club. Yeah, I mean, he came in and he was right beside me. So I kind of waited till we finished up. And I said, Mr. Smither, I have an article I wrote about you. Would you like to have it? You know, and to have the person come, about every 2 or 3 years and get to know his wife and meet his child and everything, and kind of be friends in also business with him. It's fantastic. It's like you couldn't have dreamt it. It was like, before it would be like if you just got the record, you'd be excited, or if you could even see him. But to actually hang out and go to dinner and stuff, unbelievable thrill, just unbelievable.
I love it, Michael.
Mike, are you a musician yourself?
No, I never had the stick-to-itiveness and, maybe the talent, but, I'm still a young guy. So someday, I might get on stage and be the old blues guy or something.
So blues is still your first love.
You know what I love, Sandy, is I love passion in music. Mm. I love passion and I love intelligence. And when you mash the passion and the intelligence, and then the originality, all those things. But a passion is, if I can only have one element, I want passion, and sometimes I like things and they're very cerebral and I like them for that. And, sometimes they're just pretty. And, I love poetry and I got a love of poetry from music. So a great lyric that I can identify with or that, like Woody Guthrie says, paraphrasing him, it says the words that you have in your heart or in your head. Sometimes music, you say, that's exactly how I feel. Or when it takes you someplace where you've never been and you never knew you wanted to go, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's like it opens new horizons and new boundaries for you. All of that is important.
Yeah, it's all about the passion. I think you're right. And people being able to connect with one another. Mm-hmm. In fact, not just two individuals, but I think music has been the bridge for the whole, potential for the whole world. Mm-hmm. Like the popularity of all the world music now and the concerts mm-hmm. and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that cuts through language and everything. You can really feel that when you get it. And so going back to blues, it was like just a passion in... It was like, wow.
When did you first hear the blues? Did you just accidentally hear them?
No, it's through rock and roll. I would always read, and this thing with now the digital world, people don't get to do this, but you get the record, you read the title, and under the title, they would have who wrote it. And then I started looking up who wrote those things, like E. McDaniels, I found out was Bo Diddley, so I'd go to Bo Diddley. W. Dixon, Willie Dixon, bass player with Muddy Waters, So that's how I just kept going back, digging. Then you'd read interviews with the Rolling Stones, and they'd say, oh, you got to hear Howlin' Wolf, or we got our name from a Muddy Waters song. So you just kept digging, and it was like, and those people were still alive, and they still came, and I eventually figured you could even hire them.
We're so glad you did, and thank you so much for sharing your passion with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
This afternoon.
I really enjoyed being here, so okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael, and say hi to Katie for us.
I will.
And join us again next month for another episode of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler.